This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Phil Anderson was one of the most accomplished scientists of the 20th century. When he died on the 29th of March 2020, the world of physics lost a singular talent. He was a theoretician who drew his inspiration from experiment, not from mathematics. In his long career of physics, working at the front lines, he made dozens of contributions to our understanding of solids, ordinary materials you can touch and feel. He wasn't so interested in fundamental particle physics or cosmology. But his ideas had applications across physics and deeply affected the texture of the subject. Perhaps most famous of these insights was his understanding of symmetry breaking. Picked up by others, it was applied to theories of fundamental particles consistent with quantum theory and relativity. That led to the prediction of the Higgs particle. And when that was detected, that was one of the great triumphs of recent years. I first met Phil over dinner at my friend Lily Harris Chandra's in Princeton. It was just before his 90th birthday in 2013. He was a lively, provocative conversationalist. He liked to swim against the tide. He was certainly suspicious of string theory and even of current trends in his own subject. I remember him being egged on by his old friend Freeman Dyson, who was at the same dinner table. When I was researching my new book, The Universe Speaks in Numbers, I was eager to speak with him. That book makes the case that physics and mathematics work best when they're working harmoniously and they can add a lot to each other. He would be the ideal voice for the opposition. So I went along to his office at Princeton University on the 31st of July 2013. And when I walked in, I was rather taken aback to see him sitting in front of a giant poster that featured a huge image of his face. Well, he wasn't quite an egomaniac, but he certainly knew his value to the world of physics. He told me in the interview about how he came to be interested in the subject, particularly as an undergraduate at Harvard. Although there he learnt very little quantum mechanics, he was switched on to research when he came under the wing of Julian Schwinger, one of the pioneers of quantum electrodynamics, and later by the wonderful John van Vleck, who pioneered the use of quantum mechanics in the understanding of ordinary solids. Van Vleck was to exert a huge influence on Phil, and Phil even regarded himself as a protege of the great Van Vleck. In the interview, you'll hear Phil talk about modern trends in physics, in fundamental physics. He's certainly suspicious of string theory, but hugely admiring of the talents of John Schwartz and Edward Witten, both pioneers of string theory. He'll tell us why he's suspicious of those theories, and what he would do now if he were a physicist starting out again. Now, in this podcast, there are no bells and whistles. It was recorded during the coronavirus lockdown, so please excuse the rough edges on this one. But it's really worth listening to. Phil was a great talent, and it's well worth taking in his wisdom and insights. Enjoy.
So I was naive about physics. I had I mean, I loved science.
Okay.
Or in some general. And I never knew that quantum mechanics existed as an undergraduate, for instance.
As an undergraduate?
As an undergraduate. They didn't teach quantum mechanics to undergraduates.
Could you give me the years where you were there as an undergraduate?
40 to 43.
And you were not taught quantum mechanics?
Not quantum mechanics, hardly. There
okay.
may have been a little
tiny
bit.
Tiny little bit, okay.
Tagged in at the end.
Okay.
So I learned quantum mechanics during the war. But I don't need to tell you all the stories of my life. But
yeah.
It was an interesting one because there was an old drunken old PhD physicist who was kept borrowing money from him, and finally he couldn't pay it back, and he gave me his copy of a textbook, which I still have, and from which I learned quantum mechanics.
So that what a story! I didn't know that. You're drunk. Would you care to say who this person was, or
his name was Ralph Taylor.
You lent him money, and he gave you back this book.
Yeah,
that's astounding.
And I still have it somewhere. There it is.
Oh wow!
Mathematics of Physics and Chemistry, Margineau and Murphy.
Oh wow!
You'll find his name in the front.
Yeah. Oh yes. Good Lord. From Yale. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Margineau
was a competitor in the field of my thesis. And so I got to know him very well. Not a particularly good physicist.
But yeah, this looks good, solid.
It's a very good text.
Yeah, good solid stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, okay. Anyway, sorry, this is how you got into quantum mechanics. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I learned quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And then I leapt from there into graduate school. I worked on radar during the war, equivalent of radar, electronics.
Was that MIT?
No, that was Naval Research Lab.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Lots of stories there, but you don't need to know them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I got to graduate school. We were lucky at the Naval Research Lab, unlucky in everything else because it was kind of a crummy lab, but lucky in that the Navy had Admiral Strauss later to be much hated during the Oppenheimer hearings, but he let us all free. He closed the lab down, basically. He let us out of the Navy in September and October 1945.
Mm-hmm.
So practically, with VJ Day, we were on our way out, and I could get to graduate school for that first semester of 45.
So you were set free on that day, pretty much?
What?
Set free. You were set free
yeah.
on VJ Day. Yeah.
On VJ, essentially VJ.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, September 1st.
All right. Just very soon after. Okay.
And I immediately started taking a course of three semesters of lectures by Julian Schwinger.
Oh, wow.
Knowing no quantum mechanics except what I'd learned from Ralph Taylor.
Good Lord. So, say that again, because this is fact great. You said it was a three-semester course, did you say?
Yeah. And he just, it was a core dump. Everything that he'd done up until that time, he dumped on in our laps.
Right.
All kinds of variational theory of the deuteron.
Yeah.
And wow. Waveguide theory and, Green's function theory, which he'd used to solve waveguide problems during the war.
He's a wonderful physicist, absolutely.
He is a wonderful Well, thank God, the sensation of being lectured at this level.
Good lecturer? Good lecturer in your opinion?
He was an elegant lecturer.
Okay.
You couldn't believe that he could make a mistake, but actually there were very bright guys in the class. And
okay.
And they caught him in the mistakes, and every once in a while he would say, forget the last lecture, and he would do it all.
Okay, all right.
But off the top of his head.
It's good to know that Schwinger can make mistakes, but that was 45. Wow. Right, okay. Okay, yeah. Tell me, this is thrilling. So you would lecture, you had three great courses from him.
Three great semesters, but at the same time I was learning real quantum mechanics from Furry, who was a really marvelous teacher.
Oh, right.
But much better teacher than Schwinger. And,
oh my goodness, hold on, he's very well known. This is Oppenheimer and Ferry. Is that the guy, the one I know from the paper?
Okay. Yeah, Wendell Furry was a good... Well, Wendell Furry was destroyed by this, by being attacked simultaneously by the House Un-American Activities Committee and by Schwinger coming to Harvard. And his light could never be seen. Behind
Schwinger.
Behind Schwinger.
Okay.
Lots of other great physicists were there, but none of them who really competed directly with Schwinger.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Mm. Van Vleck didn't, and Bloomberg didn't, and various other people, Purcell didn't.
Okay.
Right. It was a wonderful department. Oh. But only Furry competed directly with Schwinger.
Oh, I see, okay.
And it was just hopeless for him.
Yeah, no, I understand.
It's like having Feynman land in your life.
Yeah, I understand.
Gell-Mann would probably be even more destructive.
I know. As you say, it's unlucky if you happen to... I think that happened, this is not... Just a comment for relative to what we were saying earlier. That's what happened to Born in some degree, you know, with Heisenberg. Mm-hmm. He admitted it late in life, you know, to have this very brilliant guy that...
Well, anyhow, Furry taught wonderful, of course.
Oh, yeah.
It's had two semesters of quantum mechanics and one semester of StatMech from him.
Okay.
And that was good teaching. But I intuited the Furry effect, and so I was careful to stay out of particle physics and high energy physics. And I chose Van Vleck on that basis.
Oh! I have not thought enough of these days, in my opinion. Wow.
He was a wonderful man.
Yeah.
The most perfect gentleman one could ever imagine. You know, he almost never put his name on his student's theses. I never even brought up the question. I should have asked him, but I didn't. I just wrote it myself.
I wish I'd, when I wrote my Dirac book, I'd known this, because that was the last big trip he made to his funeral. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that he did not like travelling at that time, mm-hmm. but he flew a long way to go to that funeral. So. Mm-hmm. Mm. Anyway, so you studied with Van Vleck, who was very much an applied
quantum mechanic. Well, particularly at that time, you know, he'd been involved in the beginnings of quantum mechanics too.
Yep.
He wrote the last book on the old quantum mechanics. And then he wrote the first book, really, on solid state physics.
Okay.
And that was, contained a lot of stuff. But yes, I mean, he was. At that point, magnetic resonance, nuclear and electronic, was being invented.
Mm-hmm.
And Van Vleck's role was the to be the house theorist for the whole world, to kind of tell them like what the quantum energy levels of small molecules were that one group of people were studying.
Yeah, I see.
And how the energy levels of electrons in crystalline solids went. There was a great business in magnetic resonance of magnetic, ferromagnetic solids.
Mm.
And he sorted out the crystal field theory of these energy levels. So he was being everybody's kind of house theorist. And he gave me one of the problems that was opening up in that field.
Right.
And that was a chemical physics problem, or how do spectral lines broaden in gases. Pressure broadening.
Yeah.
And, that was a wonderful problem. And I wrote an excessively long thesis on it. I probably even have that on the shelves here somewhere. 246 pages. My wife typed it.
246 pages? Is that a review article?
Well, yeah, it wasn't a review. It was longer than... Well, yes, it was. Well, about half of it was padding that had to go in because Van wouldn't really understand things in Schwinger's type notation.
I see, yeah.
And modern notation.
Okay.
And what became modern notation.
Yeah.
Schwinger was teaching us to use correlation functions and the kind of thing that everybody does there. Does things in now, but we were just, as Schwinger was just introducing it.
Yeah, okay.
Schwinger and Martin was the first such paper. anyhow, I had to translate it into Van's notation. And that made it a little longer, but it was an enormous review article. And did.
May I ask, had you got your PhD by then, or was this your PhD?
This was my PhD.
That was your PhD, okay. In a paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
The final personal story I will tell you is that Van didn't really, well, he'd been being Lorentz professor in Leiden during the time when I'd actually done this. I had a marvelous time in graduate school for the first 2 years. And then I got married, and rather suddenly, and we had a baby on the way. And so I started to work. So I've been rather lightweight, and so Van didn't do anything specially for me. And then he started to look at my thesis. And I didn't realize it, but he suddenly realized it was a good thesis.
Okay. Yeah.
And he made my thesis committee Schwinger, Weisskopf, and himself.
My goodness gracious.
I was scared as death.
I bet you anyone would be. Yeah.
But actually, I needn't be scared because, they weren't up to that.
Yeah. And, that's right up with Feynman's one, you know, with Wheeler and Wigner and
Oh, it was. But I didn't realize that was a compliment. But anyhow, he also said casually, "Have you got a job?" And I said, "Yes. I've been offered from Westinghouse and offered Westinghouse Research Labs, and I've been offered from Pullman College in Washington State College in Pullman, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we'll have to do something about that. And he went down to Belle Isle via the Phoebe Snow, the crack train on the Lackawanna Railroad, which he could ride because he was the railroad company's consultant on schedules.
I know he had a remarkable memory for these.
He had a remarkable memory for schedules. Anyhow, he did ride the Phoebe Snow, and he talked to Shockley and Bardeen.
Oh, wow.
I interviewed there, and unimpressively, because I'd only just started on my thesis. But apparently talked them into it.
Right.
And so I got an offer, finally, from Belle Isle. And we had a back and forth with Shockley saying, I won't take a postdoc in an industrial lab, there's no such thing. I want a regular job. And I didn't realize that Bell Labs contracts are yearly anyhow.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
So he had me in mind as a postdoc.
I see. Wow.
But I wasn't a postdoc. Or I didn't think I was a postdoc. Anyhow, he accepted me. And so I went off to Bell Labs. And see, I purposely avoided the highbrow stuff, the heavily mathematical stuff, although I'd done some fairly heavy mathematics in my...
Yeah, okay.
Actually, stochastic theory was in a primitive state then, and I'd used Markov theory and stochastic theory in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd used correlation function methods.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't realize that these were advanced mathematics.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, yeah.
I just did them.
Yes, I see. Okay. Yeah.
So I was I was very much focused on solving the problem that was in front of me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I was much more like a beta student.
The great problem solver, yeah.
It's basically... problem solver.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the source of my attitude towards, and it went on from there and solved a number of problems in Bell Labs.
Mm.
And
but very close to, I would have, just I'm very, guessing very close to experiment. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the first. Actually, the second really exciting thing I did, but the first one was, I didn't realize how exciting it was until it was several years afterwards.
Yeah. And
the first one, I just assumed that all these highbrow people understood it. Mm. That was the idea of broken symmetry. I believed that everybody understood the quasi-degeneracy broken symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
I did in about the, a paper I did in 51-53.
Yeah.
Because Charlie Cattell came casually around to Gregory one day, and I, who were in the same room, and said, you have to just think about anti-ferromagnetism.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gregory and I thought about anti-ferromagnetism.
Mm-hmm.
And Gregory studied seriously the first serious case of frustrated anti-ferromagnetism, namely the triangular icing lattice.
Mm-hmm.
He showed that it had finite 0-point entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And I solved the problem of dimensionality and anti-ferromagnetism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I didn't realize that was an an important paper until much later when I realized that all these brilliant people that I had learned from didn't understand it.
Okay, I didn't know this. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But then the second thing that I did that was noteworthy, and the thing I got the Nobel Prize for, was localization.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a case of a process that's happened to me again and again. It's deep and hard mathematics. Mm-hmm. But the reason I did it was because the experiments were unequivocal.
Yeah.
And they showed that it was simply impossible that any conventional theory of transport mm-hmm. could explain localization. Mm-hmm. I had to find a new theory of transport, or non-transport. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was a very mathematical paper, but I used a model which was very, very mathematized version of the real physical system. Mm-hmm. But it was the first, perhaps the first example in which I invented a model for the purpose of explaining something, demonstrating something explicitly. Mm-hmm. mm. So I learned model building on that. Mm-hmm. 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 But it started me out with this idea that first I see an experiment which is totally in contradiction with the accepted wisdom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. Then I have to build a new accepted wisdom, mathematically.
Yeah.
And then the understanding of that mathematics is still a serious problem for the mathematicians.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it didn't start in mathematics.
No.
Well, it did. Because before I did it, I read some papers by a mathematician named Hammersley about, what is it called? Percolation.
Oh, yeah.
So I read Hammersley on percolation theory, and I realized that something like that could be worked out for quantum mechanics. On a model system for what's called impurity bands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to make an invidious comparison or an unfair comparison, but since then I've thought, that was Einstein's method. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He sees this strange fact that the two masses are the same.
Yeah.
Experimental fact, very, very simple, mm-hmm. incontrovertible. Mm-hmm. Why in hell are they the same? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He didn't start from the mathematics of
No.
Afine traces.
Yeah.
He started from an experimental fact.
Yeah.
I see. And he started from an experimental fact in electromagnetism, too. He didn't really need the Michelson-Morley experiment.
No, as he often said, yeah.
As he often said, that, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. was irrelevant, the mere facts, the facts of Maxwell's equivalent of Maxwell's equations. Mm-hmm. Are quite enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So hold on a second. What would you say? You're saying he started from what experimental thing in special relativity?
Oh, it's just the the facts of electromagnetic induction.
All right, okay. As summarized
by Maxwell's equations contain that displacement current term, mm-hmm. and so the light propagates. But Maxwell's equations don't start out with with an ether.
No.
I mean, Maxwell thought of them in as happening in an ether, but no reference to an ether in the equations.
Yeah.
So he's starting from an experiment. So that's the source of my prejudice. And what worries me about string theory is it isn't, I mean, the experimental fact is much more distant from the mathematical realization of it. Yes, there are two experiments. They really are starting from two experimental facts. And I understand that. They're starting from the experimental fact of continuous gauge groups.
Yep.
And the gauge group has got to be a symmetry of something. And the second experimental fact is that it all converges. And an easy way to make everything converge is to assume supersymmetry. So I give them that, okay, maybe they got some experimental facts. But it's awfully distant from the experimental facts.
Oh, I see. Now you're talking about the theory. Yeah, okay.
To the theory.
Okay.
I mean, the theory has been an enormous structure that has been built on these these experimental facts that are, you know, are explicable in various other ways, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, you could just start and say, okay, let's write down the theory that has these gauge groups in it. Actually, that's been shown to converge. It's a perfectly good theory, except for gravity.
You're not impressed by the apparent fact that string theory makes gravity essential. That doesn't impress you.
I think gravity's essential anyhow.
Yeah, but out of the theory, you get a spin to a graviton coming out of the equations.
Well, I guess I'm not a clued into those. To the mathematics or to the equations, as all that. I mean, I'm a relative ignoramus in string theory. I don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, I don't know it well.
Yeah, but you're suspicious. You're saying, is that fair?
I'm suspicious because it's a big structure built on. On some enormous assumptions for which there is no evidence, no contact with the experiment. You've been going on and on and on for 20, 30 years. Well, I was practically there when it started. I used to play tennis with John Schwartz.
Aspect. Yes. Was he
here
then?
A close friend.
He was here, was he?
No, he
was Caltech?
He was an Aspen guy.
Oh, I see. I always think of him as Caltech.
When I was in Aspen, we became quite friendly. I believe I even went to his wedding. And well, I spent a couple of semesters at Caltech as a Fairchild Fellow, Fairchild Professor, and he happened to be starting string theory. It was 1980, and he was starting string theory. At that time.
Yeah.
And I knew him in Aspen, from Aspen. And my tennis game hadn't deteriorated yet to the point where I couldn't play it.
So, is it fair to say that you're, please correct me if I'm wrong, but you sound as if you're a little bit concerned at the volume of research power that is put into string theory today. Is that a fair statement?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I've known Ed Witten ever since he was a graduate student.
Oh my goodness. Mm.
One of the things, you know, Ed, as a graduate student, was practically already a member of the faculty.
Why do you say that?
Well, he was more senior than me, in a sense.
Why?
I mean, I only came here in 75, and then as part-time. Gradually retiring from Bell.
Yeah.
I eventually completely retired from there in 1984.
Came here. Yeah. Okay.
But I had started in 75. And during, whether it was the first or second year, Ed actually came to me and said, would you mind doing us a couple of lectures on your work on the condo problem?
Oh, yeah.
And the X-ray edge problem and that kind of thing. And yes, I knew he was a graduate student, but he organized this set of lectures. I did three lectures for Ed Witten on this field.
Yeah.
He knew about it, and he knew that it was interesting.
Yeah.
As a graduate student, and we've been good friends ever since.
Oh, really?
That is, when Joyce and I lived in over in the rental housing here, or had an editor here, we met his family and knew them quite well.
It didn't make me laugh though when you said, I just want to check I wasn't overinterpreting it, but you said he was, from when he was a graduate student, he was practically a member of the faculty. Do you mean that he was in some sense especially talented, perceived as so, or?
Oh yes.
I see, right. Oh, you meant, yes. That's what you meant.
Yeah, well, I mean, they do, I mean, we do encourage the graduate students to run the summer school that actually is being run this moment downstairs. It's, it just finished this. After this
news. Yes.
We encourage them to do that. We're delighted that they do it. But he did that kind of thing on his own hook, with completing it.
Right. But that's not just organizing a talk. You're talking about him as a physicist as well, presumably.
Yeah, practically.
Yeah, okay.
I wasn't that close. I was, to some extent, that close with that part of the department. Actually, they were doing, that was during the period, they were doing asymptotic freedom and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I was aware of what they were doing.
Oh, okay.
But I've always been friendly with that. And I do appreciate his mathematics, and he's terrific.
Mm.
He's been going to our stuff on quantum information and so on.
Mm.
He's very interested in that.
Is he? I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that is news to me.
So we find him in most of the quantum information type talks.
I once heard T.D. Lee say it was clothed, but it was undeniable what he meant. He said I remember very clearly him talking in front of the hall. This is 20 years ago, and he said that he was worried that a subject could be dominated by someone of such brilliance. He was talking about Edward, of course, right? And he worried that the analogy he feared. That it might be like Einstein post 1926. You know, he wasn't quite that explicit, but he was not denying in any way it was great brilliance, but he was concerned that the influence he had was monumental, as opposed to simply a brilliant person among many other talents.
Well, he didn't do it, doesn't do it alone, didn't do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Murray, for instance, created, although he hasn't done string theory himself, created the cocoon in which Schwartz and Green could work.
Oh, yeah, Murray Gell-Mann, yeah.
Murray Gell-Mann.
Yeah.
So his influence is very important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, well, David McGross makes no secret of throwing his weight around.
Yes, I know.
I mean, everybody does it.
Yes.
Well, I don't think it's Ed's.
No, I'm not suggesting he was...
Ed has to be blamed.
No, please, I wasn't suggesting he was using it improperly. I was just saying that when you have a talent that is very, very big, it's not like when you had Einstein and Bohr and upcoming people like Heisenberg and Dirac, you know, it seems that Edward is an overwhelming talent in that field. Maybe that's my error, but that's what I think he was suggesting. But maybe that's not right.
Yeah, it certainly frightens me to be on the, to be even tentatively on the other side from it.
I don't think you've got anything to worry about. Freeman Dyson, you'll be abused to hear, says, now, Phil Anderson, he's a real physicist. This is what he said to me last year. I was very struck
by that. Well, I'm glad he thinks so.
He did say that, I promise you. I like the implication that most others are unreal.
Well, yeah.
So what would your advice...
There are a lot of unreal ones.
I know. But tell me, if you had if you had somebody now, a young person coming in, right?
I would keep him out of string theory.
Well, you took the word right out of my mouth. No, I didn't say that. But you have someone really brilliant going into graduate school or something, and they throw themselves at your feet and say, right, Professor Anderson, just tell me what broadly would be your advice? What would it be?
Well, I know what I would do myself.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wouldn't be in physics. I would be in neurophysiology.
All right. But you said stay out of string theory, then.
I would stay out of string theory.
Right.
Because it's turning out to be a dead end, and all the little wiggles. Wait until some experiment.
Excuse me, I'm borrowing a pen because my one's run out. If this one works.
I mean, there's a lot of... Well, the other thing I would, if he was still persistent, I would insist that he go into astrophysics and cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are soluble problems. Somebody's going to figure out what dark matter and dark energy are.
Mm-hmm. Is the implication that you think string theory is not a soluble problem? Is that what you're...
Well, it's not going to condense on one thing until you've got more experimental evidence.
Phil Anderson's key message is that theoretical physicists would be well advised to stick to parts of nature where the theorists can test their theories against accurate experimental data. Now, for most of us, that's very good advice. But I would argue that if you really want to understand all the fundamental forces of nature, all the fundamental particles under one framework, and to understand the nature of space and time, then in the world as we find it at the moment, with very few really exciting new experimental data, then mathematics is an invaluable lodestar. That's the key message of my book, The Universe Speaks in Numbers. Another way of putting it is that the patterns underlying the universe are what we're seeking. Patterns that are identified by experimental observations, but also codified in terms of mathematics. So we can focus on either the experimental observations or the mathematics that is that codifies those patterns. After Phil and I recorded the podcast, we went and had a good lunch in Princeton over a rather nice bottle of wine. We talked about our views of the way physics was going, and he asked me to send him a copy of The Universe Speaks in Numbers, which I did a few months ago. I was looking forward to talking about the book and many other things with him in the summer of 2020. Alas, it wasn't to be. Rest in peace, Phil Anderson.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.